Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
He has a long record of petty crimes in Thunder Bay. He is, or should I say was, a mechanic at a local repair shop up to 18 months ago. He fell off our radar after that. His crimes range from petty theft to assault on his aged grandfather to fifth-degree sexual assault of a juvenile. For that crime, all he had to do was pay a fine because he had no prior history of sex crimes. It says here he pleaded for leniency on the grounds he was intoxicated and thought the girl he fondled was his girlfriend. How in the world did he get through customs with that record? Deidre inquired. That's a question that needs to be answered. I suppose we could chalk it up to an administrative error, or worse, to a corrupt system. Either way, it's inexcusable he was allowed passage from our country to yours, or vice versa. Perhaps Mr. Leader walked that fine line between misdemeanors and more serious charges and never raised a flag when he applied for a passport. We may never know the answer, he shook his head in disgust. Is there any chance I can speak with Kimmy's aunt, Sally Cloud? I want to be back in Two Harbors tonight, and if I leave Thunder Bay by 8 o'clock, I'll be okay. Charles reached for his phone. I had one of my staff look up her number. I'll give her a call. If she cooperates, I think we can have you on your way much sooner than 8. He dialed a number, and Deidre listened to his conversation, trying to fill in what Aunt Sally was saying on the other end by the chief's response. Finally, he hung up. She says we can come to her place, but we can't stay long. Said her husband will be home soon, and he's usually drunk. She advised us not to be there when he arrives. Deidre followed Charles from his office to the underground garage and climbed into his vehicle. When they were outside on the street, she was dismayed to see how heavily it was snowing. They maneuvered the side roads until they came to a run-down bungalow. This is where Sally lives and where Kimmy spent most of her time. Let me initiate the conversation. Deidre stood slightly behind him as he knocked on the door. It was opened by a much younger woman than Deidre had expected. I'm Charles Freeman, Chief of Police of Nan. I called earlier. Are you Sally Cloud? The woman nodded, pushing a hank of hair that dropped over her left eye into place on top of her head. Come in, she said softly, never making eye contact. So you're here about Kimmy. Is she all right? She's safe, Charles responded. She's getting treatment in a hospital in Duluth, Minnesota. Oh, was all Sally said. This is Deidre Johnson with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. She's assisting the Lake County Sheriff on Kimmy's behalf. Actually, she saved her life. Will you answer some questions for her? Sally nodded and looked at the floor. Deidre cleared her throat. I'm terribly sorry to have to bother you, but Kimmy might still be in a great deal of danger. Thank you for speaking with me. Poor kid. She hasn't had much chance at all. Her mother was pretty wild and got pregnant by Lord knows who. Then she kept using drugs after Kimmy was born. I more or less raised her. She stayed with me when her mother was off on her highs. Finally, Alicia took off, and I haven't seen her for 2 years. I took Kimmy in, but this house is no place to raise a child. She spent more time on the street than she did here. Sally turned her head as if she wanted to hide her face. You said she'd been gone 2 weeks before you reported her missing. Can I ask why you waited so long? This was her pattern. At first, I'd report her missing right away, but they'd always find her at a friend's house or some other place she was staying. After a while, I quit bothering the police. This time, when she didn't come home after 2 weeks, I thought something must be wrong. The police never found her. Sally turned away from them again. Sally, can you tell me if Kimmy had any friends who might know what happened? All I know is she said she had a boyfriend who, according to her, treated her very well. She wouldn't tell me his name, so I can't help you there. All she said was that he was interested in the woods and had a canoe. Sometimes they'd go to a lake and paddle around. Now you'd better leave. My husband will be home soon, and he wouldn't like it if he knew I was talking to you. Deidre and Charles thanked Sally for her time, knowing that staying longer would cause her trouble. She and Charles discussed the situation. Did you notice that Sally never once asked when Kimmy was being released from the hospital? I don't think she'll have any place to go when and if she recovers. Deidre had picked up on that issue as well. I don't think Sally wants her to come back. After seeing what we saw, I don't think I do either. She's probably safer where she is than back here. The two rode in silence for several blocks. I was just thinking, Deidre said. Anna and Kimmy came from vastly different homes. Anna's parents were caring and involved in her life, perhaps a little too much so, but we really don't know. Teenagers rebel against what they see as controlling parents, even if the parents are really quite grounded. On the other hand, Kimmy was left to raise herself, yet they both ended up in the same situation. Except for a few seconds, she would have been dead too. After a pause, Deidre added, "Sometimes there are no answers." This was more to herself than her companion. Charles pulled into the parking lot and Deidre got out. She leaned back into his SUV. "Thanks so much for all you're doing to help. I guess this is a battle we both want to win." With that, she backed out, shut the door, and walked to her vehicle. Not until she pulled onto the street did it dawn on her that it had quit snowing. On the way back to Two Harbors on Highway 61, she remained vigilant, not wanting another close encounter with a deer. It was just before 8 when she parked her SUV behind Inga's. She let Pete out of his kennel and ruffled his ears. "Sorry, boy. I know the days must be long for you, but nothing lasts forever. We'll get through this and back to our cabin soon." And to herself, she added, "I hope." Chapter 18. "I'm back," Deidre greeted Jill as she entered the office. She hadn't had breakfast or even a cup of coffee yet. "Hi, boss lady. Looks like you had a long night. Anything good come from your meeting yesterday?" "Jane Doe has a name, Kimmy Thomas. She's pretty much an orphan with nowhere to turn for help. I spoke with her aunt, who appears to be in an abusive relationship herself. Certainly not a situation I'd want to release the girl back to. We're getting a few pieces to this picture, but so far none of them are fitting together. It's going to take some time, but they will. Anything new for me today?" "It's on your desk. You have an appointment with Dr. Bilka, the pediatrician who's treating... What did you say her name is? Kimmy? That's at 10. Then at 11:30, you'll be meeting with Dr. Selenka, her psychiatrist. Oh, I didn't have time to put this down. The phone was ringing when I came in this morning. Gerald Coulter wants you to call him as soon as you have an opportunity. He sounded quite disturbed." "Coulter?" Deidre stiffened at the name. "What does he want from me? To rub my face in his legal technicalities some more? That smug SOB can walk off the end of the breakwater as far as I'm concerned." "Calm down, boss lady. This isn't the Gerald Coulter you're thinking of. It's Gerald Coulter III, his son. He said you'd remember him. Do you?" Deidre sat down and let her vitriol ebb away. "I had a run-in with him a few years ago. The head of the drug and gang task force of the area and I executed a search warrant at an address in Two Harbors. Gerald was there, stoned. He had a mouth as smart as his dad's, the sarcastic little punk. Anyway, when we took him home, his father raised the roof, not with him, but with us for accusing his son of being a junkie. That was the incident that caused Coulter II to begin a recall petition that forced me from office. Yeah, you might say I remember Gerald Coulter III. He wanted me to call him? His number is on this sticky note. Do you need it on better paper?" Deidre shook her head and stuffed it in her pocket. "I'd better be heading for Duluth if I'm going to make my first appointment. Take care of the shop." On the way, she speed dialed Ben on her phone. "Hey," she said when he answered, knowing he had caller ID. "I'm on my way to your town. Would you mind if I stop to see the girls later today? I'll cook if it's okay with you." "A home-cooked meal? Are you kidding? That'd be great. What are we having?" Then he added, "Of course it'll be good to see you again. After Thanksgiving with my mother, I wondered if you'd ever call back." Deidre laughed. "It'll take more than your mother to keep me from my two favorite kids. See you after work." She parked across the street from the hospital and walked to the entrance. The city crew had draped garlands from the light poles, and they hung motionless in the cold, early winter air. The lobby was decorated for the holiday season. A Christmas tree in the center of the foyer, its colored lights flashing in time to a carol being played, a pile of faux presents piled at its base, and a 6-foot wreath on the wall. Christmas had never meant much to Deidre. Most of her memories of the season were of her drunken stepfather knocking over their tree or passing out on the floor. Her mother tried as best she could to be festive, but there never was money to buy gifts, and their Christmas meal was usually nothing special. When John, her fiancé, was alive, she had gotten a taste of what a joyful time of year December could be, but that had been taken from her when he was gunned down. She hoped for Megan's and Marin's sake she could recapture some of the joy. Dr. Bilka had asked that they meet in a conference room in the hospital, and Deidre stopped at the information desk to ask directions. The volunteer pointed her to an elevator at the end of the hall and instructed her as to the floor and room number. She was about to enter the room when a woman in a white coat bustled down the hall. "Hello, I'm Jan Bilka. Are you Deidre?" Before Deidre could answer, the pediatrician opened the door and indicated for her to go in. "Please have a seat. I've just finished rounds and don't have to be to my office for an hour, so we have some time to talk. Do you have any specific questions for me?" Deidre realized the doctor hadn't even checked to see if she was Deidre or if she had any credentials. She reached in her pocket for her ID. "I thought you'd like to verify that I'm with the BCA before we started," and she held out her tag. The doctor blushed, embarrassed that she had been in such a rush to get started that she had broken protocol. Deidre continued, "First, I believe we have a name for your patient. Did you find any marks on her that can be used for identification purposes?" Dr. Bilka booted up a small laptop computer she carried. "What exactly are you looking for?" she asked. "I have her medical record here." "If she is who I believe she is, the girl should have a 2-inch crescent-shaped scar on her right hip. She should also have a scar from an appendectomy. You might not have the last marker. When she was a young child, she broke her left ankle quite badly. Her missing persons information said it was the left medial malleolus of her tibia." "That one I remember," said Dr. Bilka. "Because of the condition of her feet when she was admitted, I ordered x-rays. I remember her previously broken ankle because it is not too common for a break to occur to the medial malleolus. Most frequently, it's the fibula that breaks. Let me check her record for the others. Yes, she has a scar similar to what you described. And yes, she had an appendectomy." "All three markers coincide with what you said would be there. What's her name?" "Kimmy Thomas. She's of Cree Indian descent and is from Thunder Bay, Ontario. She's been missing since late June. She's only 13 years old." "My God, I knew she was young, but I didn't suspect quite that young. She's experienced a great deal of trauma, more than you can imagine, and more than I've ever seen in a child. Who did this to her?" "That's what we have to find out. So far, we're not making much progress, but many cases begin like that. It's like a snowball, starting with a small core and gaining mass as it rolls along. But we're not going to rest until we find the person or persons responsible." Dr. Bilka went on to explain what Kimmy had suffered, and Deidre could only listen with revulsion. Finally, she asked, "Will she recover?" "Physically, yes. Emotionally, probably not. And when I say physically, she will heal, but her not fully developed reproductive system has been severely traumatized. How that will affect her as an adult is impossible to say, but we can make a pretty accurate assumption." Dr. Bilka looked at her watch. "I'm sorry to cut our meeting off at this point, but I really must go. I'm late for office hours as it is. Thank you so much for seeing me. Please catch whoever did this. I want to see what the animal looks like." Deidre drove to Dr. Selinka's office. She parked across from the medical arts building and rode the elevator to the 15th floor. At the end of the hall was an office with a sign, Dr. William Selinka, MD, Psychiatry. Other than his receptionist, the office was empty, and Deidre was relieved to think he would not be rushing to get to his next patient. "You must be Deidre Johnson. Dr. Selinka's waiting for you. He's cleared a block of time. Do you have proper identification?" Deidre presented her card with her photo attached. "Please come this way." The receptionist led her down a hall to the doctor's inner office. Dr. Selinka was an older gentleman. He had a full head of gray hair and a sad but kindly look in his eyes. When he spoke, his voice was soothing. "Have a seat, Deidre. Is it okay if I call you Deidre? And please call me Bill. I hate formalities." Immediately, Deidre felt comfortable with him. "What can I do to help you?" he asked. "First, I'm quite certain I know the girl's name," Deidre began. "DNA results will be the final confirmation, but everything else points to a girl missing in Thunder Bay, Kimmy Thomas. She's been missing since the end of June. Dr. Selenka, Bill, showed surprise by raising his eyebrows. So you have a name. That may be one of the keys to opening her mind. So far, she has shown no sign of responding to the nurses, except for the male nurses. When they enter her room, she flies into a panic. We've had to restrict her care to only females. As for myself, she tolerates my presence, barely, but she simply turns me off. She will make no eye contact whatsoever. May I ask what psychiatric treatment she's receiving? I won't understand it in medical terms, so just give me the layman's overview. Under these circumstances, I think I can share with you. We have her on a mild sedative to take the edge off her anxiety. I also started her on an antidepressant. At night, we give her Ambien to help her sleep. Other than that, we're trying to get her to take nourishment, although her appetite is very poor. Her pediatrician, who by the way is one of the best with abuse cases, says her physical healing is progressing nicely. Have you spoken with her? Deidre told him about her meeting with Dr. Bilka. Good, then you know about her physical condition. But the mental and the physical are so entwined, it's sometimes impossible to separate the two. I believe, of course, I'm a psychiatrist, he chuckled, that her mind must be healed first. Her body will follow. I think you're one person whose presence might allow her to begin to crawl out of her pit. As I said, I have set aside a block of time today to speak with you. Will you be willing to come with me and see the girl? Kimmy, is it? That's an unusual name. Any significance to it? Kimmy is Cree. I'm sure it has a meaning, but I don't know what. Bill nodded and escorted Deidre out of his office. I can drive. I have a reserved parking spot in the hospital ramp. Doctor's privilege, he chuckled again, and Deidre knew she liked him. They passed through security, and he softly knocked on her door. This is Dr. Selenka. We're going to come in now. He slowly opened the door to Kimmy's room, enough so he and Deidre could slip inside. He silently closed the door behind them. Kimmy was sitting in a wheelchair near the window, and from her vantage point, she had a view of the Duluth Superior Harbor. She didn't turn to look at them. Bill moved in front of her. Still, she didn't move a muscle, but sat staring straight ahead. I have someone to see you, he said in his steady voice, and rotated the chair so she was facing Deidre. Hello, Kimmy, Deidre said as tears welled up in her eyes. Do you remember me? All Deidre could see was the image of Kimmy lying in a catatonic state, her eyes blank and urine spilling onto the snow when she had totally given up. Kimmy stirred, and then Deidre spotted what she would describe as instant recognition. The girl grabbed her arm and clutched it to her chest, nearly cutting off the circulation to Deidre's hand. Then Kimmy placed her face against the arm she was squeezing and began to sob. Anna, Anna, she said over and over. Deidre looked into her eyes and could see a plea, the first expression Kimmy had shown since she was rescued. Do you know Anna? Was she your friend? All Kimmy could do was repeat, Anna. Deidre knelt down beside her and placed her arms around Kimmy. For a time they stayed that way, Deidre cradling the child, Kimmy resting her head on Deidre's shoulder. She reached up and swept the girl's long black hair off her face. She's beautiful, she thought. Kimmy, I have to leave now. She saw instant panic shroud Kimmy's eyes. But I'll be back whenever I can to see you. We can talk, okay? But Dr. Selenka, you know him, will see you every day. He's a good man and won't hurt you. You can trust him. Deidre had to pry Kimmy's hands from her arm. She stooped and kissed the girl on her forehead. I'll be back, I promise. The doctor and she stepped into the hall. I can't believe what I just witnessed, he said. I thought you might be one of the keys, but I didn't think you'd be the key. I hope we can move on from here. But who is this Anna she kept asking for? Do you have any idea? Unfortunately, I do, Deidre said. And then she related the story of the murdered girl she had found. Bill took her hand. Thank you for all you've done today. I just hope we can keep making progress now. You'll continue to see her, won't you? And if the time comes when I think it would be beneficial for the three of us to be together, may I call you? Deidre assured him that would be all right. The doctor gave her a ride back to the medical arts building, and she drove away in her own car. She was headed to Ben's, and all she wanted to do was hold the twins close. Megan and Marin were playing outside in the snow when she pulled into the driveway. Dropping everything, they rushed pell-mell to greet her. Deirdre dropped down on her knees and wrapped her arms around them. She could feel the coolness of their cheeks when she kissed them. Then, laughing, she wrestled them into a snowbank, pretending to let them pin her down. "Okay, okay, you got me," she complained in mock fear. Deirdre looked up and saw the sitter watching them out of the window, a broad grin on her face. She waved and Deirdre waved back. "Come with me, girls. Let's go inside and have hot chocolate. Are there any cookies left from Thanksgiving?" "No, Daddy ate them all. But we can still have cocoa. Sometimes we have it with cinnamon toast. Do you know how to make cinnamon toast, Deirdre?" By that time, they were in the vestibule of the house, stomping off the loose snow and stripping off their outerwear. The sitter said, "You girls sure love Deirdre, don't you? And I can tell she loves you right back." Deirdre hugged them. "You two are so precious." She turned to the sitter. "Is it okay that I'm here before Ben? I know it cuts into your hours." The sitter assured her that it was no problem and prepared to leave. "They need someone like you in their lives. You're more important to them than you know. Your name must come up 100 times a day." With that, she left the three alone. They had hot chocolate and toast with cinnamon, sang some songs together, played dollies, and cooked a simple supper. "Daddy's home," they called out in unison when they heard the door open. "Deirdre's here. Come see what she made for supper." "Doesn't it look good, Daddy?" Marin asked in her excited little girl voice. "Mmm," he responded. "I can hardly wait." Deirdre stood back, strangely feeling she should rush up and give him a hug or something. Instead, she waved a half wave and said, "Good to see you so soon again. Hope you don't mind that I've shown up." She smiled an awkward grin. "Mind? What's to mind? You're always welcome here. You know that. Isn't she, girls?" His invitation received a rousing yes. After supper, the four of them played a game of old maid and then got the girls ready for bed. "I have to leave now, kids. Got a busy day tomorrow, but I'll see you soon, okay?" They grumbled and clung to her arms. Too much, they reminded her of Kimmy and the way she had not wanted to let go. "Hey, let Deirdre go now," Ben said. "She has a job to do, just like I do, and she needs a rest." "Tell you what, maybe if you ask really nice, she'd come back this weekend and help us decorate the Christmas tree. How would you like that?" Marin looked at her through serious eyes. "Would you do that, Deirdre?" Deirdre's heart melted. "Oh, that would be lovely. What time would you like me to come?" "How about Friday night?" Ben interjected. She looked at him and he had a crooked grin on his face. "Friday night it is." Chapter 19. Deirdre was almost to the east end of Duluth when her cell phone rang. She pulled over to the side of the road and reached for it in her coat pocket, but it wasn't there. She tried another pocket with the same result. "I hate all of these clothes we have to wear in winter. Never can find anything when you need it," she thought. She located the phone in an inner pocket and pulled it out, along with a slip of paper. Disregarding the paper, she saw a message waiting light blinking on the phone. After listening to it for a few seconds, she cut it off. "Telemarketer," she mumbled to herself. Suddenly, she remembered what the scrap of paper was about, turned on the reading light above the dash, and unwrinkled the note. Written on it was a name, Gerald Coulter, and a phone number. Although it was getting late, she decided to call. The phone rang several times before it was answered. "Hello?" she heard a tentative voice on the other end. "This is Gerald speaking." "Hi, this is Deirdre Johnson, returning your call. I know it's rather late. I can call back tomorrow if you wish." "No, no, this is all right. I was afraid you wouldn't want to talk to me. After all, the last time you saw me, I wasn't exactly Mr. Charming. I apologize for the way I acted." "Well, thank you for taking the time to tell me that, Gerald. It's nice of you." She wondered why, after so much time, he would want to unburden himself. "But that isn't why I called," Gerald continued. His voice sounded choked up. "I'm a student at St. John's University near St. Cloud." "Yes, I know where that is," Deirdre interrupted, thinking he wanted to let her know that his life wasn't a waste after all. "I subscribed to the local newspaper and read about the girl who was murdered in Silver Bay. As I read the article, I discovered that you were working on the case. I need to speak with you immediately about it. I have information that's imperative you access. Will you meet me so I can show you what I've got in my possession?" Deirdre was dumbfounded. Finally, she came to her senses. "Why, certainly, where are you?" "I'm in Collegeville, where the university is located. I don't want anyone to see me talking with you or knowing that I've contacted you. It's asking a lot, but would you drive down here to see me? It's only a 3-hour drive from Duluth. At least half of it's on freeway. That way, chances are no one will see us. I know this is strange, but I have to get this into your hands as soon as possible. Deidre already knew how to respond. Well, sure, if it's as important as you say, but I'm terribly busy on the case and don't have time to waste. Believe me, this won't be a waste of your time. When can you be here? Deidre did some rough calculations in her head. Probably 10 o'clock tomorrow morning at the earliest. Where can I find you? I'll be waiting on the steps of the Abbey Church. We'll be able to find a place we can meet privately without interruption. Believe me, what I have is so important that I must get it to you. After the phone call, and while she was driving home, Deidre had the strange feeling she was somehow being set up. But Gerald's voice carried with it such a sense of urgency, she decided he couldn't be faking it. After letting Inga know she was home, Deidre took Pete for a long walk. The temperature had moderated, and the thermometer registered closer to the seasonal average, 20 degrees above zero. Pete ran ahead of her, checking out every new smell and marking every light post. She wondered where all that marking material came from. He never seemed to run dry. Deidre thought she would be able to sleep after a 3-mile walk in the fresh air, but she was wrong. The last time she looked at the red numbers of her digital clock, it was well after midnight. When the alarm sounded, she was sure she had just fallen asleep. She reached for the snooze button and then bolted upright, remembering that she had to be at St. John's University in 3 hours. After a quick cup of coffee and a piece of peanut butter toast, she was on her way out of town. A little after 7, she called Jill at the office. "Jill, I've got something important going on. While I'm gone, I want you to search for any business that has the initials RRR. Begin with Lake County and expand your search. If you run across any that seem to be fronts or not totally legit, flag them. I'm not too sure what you'd be looking for. I guess use your intuition. Anyway, pay attention to any that might be associated with our case." She smiled when Jill responded in her usual irreverent manner. "Thanks, Jill. See you tomorrow." Deidre made a mandatory stop at Toby's Bakery and bought a caramel roll and a cup of coffee to go. She turned west on Minnesota Highway 23, a twisting two-laner that made for an exasperating trip, especially because the driver in front was in no hurry to get where he was going. Deidre wanted to push the gas pedal to the floor, but had to follow the string of cars in front of her. At exactly 10 o'clock, she stopped in front of the steps of the church at St. John's Abbey. Gerald saw her and waved as though she were his long-lost friend. He slid into the passenger seat of her SUV. "I'm grateful you came to see me. I've struggled over this thing for 3 days, and I've concluded we have to talk."
You've been listening to Episode 10 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors, here on Literally from the North Shore.